This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, and welcome to the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health's In Conversation podcast. I'm Ella Rhodes, and recently I spoke to Professor Tamsin Ford, a child and adolescent psychiatrist based at the University of Exeter's Medical School. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today, Tamsin. I wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about how you got involved in child and adolescent psychiatry in the first place.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I went into psychiatry to be an old age psychiatrist. And I got a little bit lost. I did my what would now be called core psychiatric training. So that's the first 3 years where you spend time in short jobs, so often 4 to 6 months in different areas of psychiatry, getting a broad base of experience. And I was lucky to do mine in the East End of London, which is a really exciting, vibrant place. And I guess what attracted me to old age psychiatry was the close relationship to physical medicine and the way that somebody's physical health impacted on their mental health and vice versa. So I think it's not an unusual choice in very junior psychiatrists because it's still very grounded in medical medicine, if you like. But I guess old age psychiatry, as opposed to liaison psychiatry, which is the interface between mental and physical health, is interesting because it's all about families and systems. And actually, it's not a million miles away from child psychiatry. And towards the end of my core training, I did a job which was actually split between old age psychiatry and child psychiatry in this small rotation that I trained on. And my thinking was that I had important exams coming up that I learned better from actual experience than from textbooks, so I could do a bit of child psychiatry. But look, there was this job that would allow me to get some more old age psychiatry experience. And I came out the other end of that job thinking, actually, child psychiatry offers everything that old age psychiatry offers, but it also has the developmental complexity as well. And just, you know, I really wasn't expecting to love it as much as I did. But from that moment, I set about turning myself into a child psychiatrist.
So you're the lead of the Child Mental Health Research Group at Exeter University's Medical School. I mean, how did it come about that you kind of took a research sort of route as well?
So I did my specialist training in child psychiatry at the Bethlehem and Maudsley Hospital. So I was really lucky to work with some real experts in their fields, both in research and in the treatment of children with particular conditions. And I was unusual in the kind of trainee that went on that programme in that I hadn't done any research, and exposure to really high quality research allowed me to better understand the importance and the power of research. But it seemed to me that there was a real gap in terms of the type of research that's immediately relevant to policy, both clinical policy, social policy and public health policy, which I then set about filling. So, you know, as I went into psychiatry to be an old age psychiatrist, I went into child psychiatrist to be a clinician. But actually, I think I've ended up probably helping more people by stepping into research.
And so much of your research involves kind of looking into interventions within schools particularly. I mean, could you talk a little bit about why it's important that we look at schools particularly and children and young people's mental health kind of at school?
Schools are really, really important to children's mental health, and it is really encouraging to see the current policy and clinical and also educational interest in children's mental health within the school context. I first got interested because all the research I was doing kept pointing back to schools as a pivotal focus for children's mental health. So my PhD studied the rates and predictors of access to services in relation to children's mental health. And in that work, teachers were the most commonly consulted professional. And I don't think from colleagues, from my clinical experience, and certainly, later on talking to people, many more people who work in the educational field, I don't think that is a role that teachers feel particularly prepared or supported in, but they do recognise the fact that they are often called upon to deal with students' mental health, that they deal with it, the impact of it in the classroom quite regularly, and also that other people often come to them asking about children's mental health. And you can see why a parent who was worried about their child's mental health might approach teachers as a first line, because they have a longitudinal view of children. They deal with the whole spectrum of children's abilities, both educationally and in terms of social skills and their emotions and their behaviour. And therefore, I think it's not surprising that parents expect teachers to know about this. And it means that we should better equip teachers to fulfil this role.
And one of the projects you've recently come to the end to, your STARS project, has it involved teachers being trained? Could you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yes, STARS, which stands for Supporting Teachers and Children in Schools, is one of my favourite studies. It was the study I really wanted to do because it took account of the fact that the commonest mental health problem in children is behaviour that challenges others. The national prevalence surveys in the UK suggest that about 5% of children meet diagnostic criteria for conduct disorder. And we could debate for an hour about whether or not there should be such a diagnosis, but there is. And more importantly, children who fulfil criteria for that diagnosis have appalling outcomes, not only in relation to mental health. So having a diagnosis of conduct disorder in childhood predicts to every adult mental health condition there is, including anxiety, depression and psychosis, and not just substance misuse and personality disorder, which you might predict from the nature of the childhood problems. But also they have poor educational and social care outcomes. So it's a really, really common and really important problem. Secondly, it's a thing that teachers really struggle with. So in the clinics, when you assess a child and speak to their teacher as part of that assessment, the teacher will often be struggling to cope with the child in school. And I have many friends who are teachers who regularly ring me up in a state of distress, a stress about managing a child. And we know from the statistics that teachers' mental health is affected by struggling to manage children's behaviour in schools, and often the difficulties and the feeling of lack of support and options in dealing with challenging behaviour at school is cited as a reason for teachers leaving the profession. So this is a major, major problem, both from the health perspective and also from the education perspective. So the STARS study took an established programme for children's behaviour, which is the Incredible Years programme, which was initially developed with three strands envisaged around children who had conduct disorders. So there was a strand for the parents, there was a course for the children, and there was another course for the teachers. What STARS did was take the teacher programme out and employ it as a public health intervention, because no amount of training parents is going to sort out a problem that's based at school. Some parents don't have the time or the wherewithal or the access to parenting courses. So in other words, training teachers not only supports the child who is struggling, but also the other children in the class whose education might be disrupted, and potentially the class teacher as well. So what we did was we randomly assigned 40 teachers, one teacher from each school, to go on the course, and the other schools and teachers carried on with teaching as usual. And we gathered measures that assessed children's mental health, the teacher's mental health burnout, and professional self-efficacy. And also we got the teachers to rate the children's attainment. And we did that before they knew who was going on the course and who wasn't. And then we went back in June of the same academic year and got the same teachers to rate the children again. And then we went in the next two subsequent academic years in February again to collect the same set of measures. So we've now gathered all these data and we're beginning to analyse them.
And can you tell us anything about sort of preliminary results or reactions from the teachers themselves?
Our qualitative data are extremely powerful. So this intervention is feasible in that teachers find it useful and appropriate, and it's sat with their training. Attendance at the course was very high, and they saw and used the techniques, and they talked about it very powerfully as changing their mindset, changing their practice, and also greatly improving teacher-pupil relationships. Now, sadly, that was not something we measured, and we would recommend that future studies do measure. In terms of what our questionnaire measures showed, we had our primary outcome was teachers' rating of the children's mental health. Now, bearing in mind, this is primary school children aged between 4 and 7 at baseline. So their mental health on the whole, because this was mainstream primary school, is pretty good. We did, in that first year, that whilst they were being taught by a teacher who was going to the course, we did demonstrate a very small improvement in their mental health, which was statistically significant. And I think if you are realistic about a public health intervention, you're not going to expect massive change because you are starting with a healthy population. So for those that are doing really well, in fact, there isn't room to improve their mental health, but hopefully what you're doing is building social skills for life that may help protect their mental health going forward. For those who are a little bit vulnerable, maybe you are not only promoting mental health, but you're preventing a deterioration. And the really exciting thing we found is that for the children who were struggling, so they were scoring above clinical cut points on our measure, the strengths and difficulties questionnaire, we had a differentially larger effect on them, which suggested that this is a really good way, although it's a universal intervention, it is a really good way of accessing children who were struggling to begin with. Other exciting things is that we had a sustained effect on children's behaviour over 30 months, and we had a sustained effect on children's attention over 30 months. So again, this is a public health intervention. We may, the effect sizes are small, but this is not an intervention in a clinic, so you wouldn't expect them to be big. But what we hope we have done is set up small improvements in children's trajectory early on that actually, if they're maintained over time, and for concentration and low-level disruptive behaviour it was, even though they weren't then taught by a teacher familiar with the course in the next 2 years, maybe that translates to bigger effects further down the line.
So teachers really do have a massive influence, don't they? I mean, what kind of skills do the teachers take away from the Incredible Years course that they go on?
Well, anyone who is interested should have a browse around the Incredible Years website, because there's a wealth of materials and videos where people can find out a huge amount of information. But the courses are empirically based on established psychological theories, particularly the theories, very basic psychology in terms of the reinforcement of behaviour being driven by attention, and that when behaviour is challenging, that adults and children get into vicious circles, coercive circles, where only difficult behaviours attended to, and therefore the children almost compete to behave badly, because that's what gets attention. Whereas if the teacher is very clear about what the expectations are and praises the kids who are doing what they're told and is very explicit in their praise about, you know, what's desired and what's good. So instead of good boy Johnny, you're sitting really nice and quietly, you're listening very carefully. That then sends a message to the rest of the class about what gets attention, and the children will then all start doing more of that. And I think teachers said on the course that they were very aware of these theories and their application, but this in the face of directives from Ofsted, from other policy measures, gave them the kind of faith that what they knew was right. But also, I think it often people think that they are praising people for what they do well, but they don't do it nearly as much as they think. So one of the practical suggestions that's sometimes used to get this point across to teachers is to advise them to take some marbles or stones or buttons or something in one pocket whilst they teach a class, and to move one to the other pocket each time they praise someone. And mostly, and it's something we can all try in our everyday work, because actually it doesn't hurt to encourage people. And actually it's quite shocking how few pebbles or marbles you've moved by the end of the day. We don't do it nearly as much. So that's the foundation. Very clear about what you want and praise for when you get it. And then being proactive in managing challenging behaviour. So if you have a student who is a bit tricky and likely to get restless after sitting for a short while of time, give them a reason to get up and move around and praise them for sitting as long as they have. So you get in before the bad behaviour has happened, and you have a plan for managing your trickier students, which might be having the children who get a bit disruptive right in front of you so you can safely ignore them because you can keep an eye on them. So not attending to low-level disruption is not the same as not being aware of it, if you see what I mean. It's that you direct your attention to what you want to encourage. And then if, you know, children will make mistakes, we all make mistakes, but it's being very clear about why there's been a mistake and what's going to happen. So if you don't finish your work, you will have to stay in at break time and finish it. So the children are then seeing that there are consequences linked to their behaviour, both positive and negative, and that they have a choice, and that you help structure the classroom so that they make wise choices and those wise choices are reinforced.
Tamsin, could you tell us a little bit about the research you're working on currently and anything you've got planned for the future?
Well, I have another really interesting, exciting and novel project that will finish at the end of the year called Catch Us. Whereas STARS was very young children, so we had children as young as four completing questionnaires for us, this moves to the other end of the child mental health lifespan, if you want, and is about transition in young adults with ADHD. So child mental health services historically were set up to offer episodic care, but actually for neurodevelopmental conditions that often result in a degree of impairment that carries on into adult life and is certainly long term, that kind of episodic, you know, coming in to support people, sorting them out and discharging them, that begins to fall down. And our paediatric colleagues are much better at thinking through this problem because they've just had to with things like diabetes and epilepsy and certain forms of childhood disability that might require ongoing care into adulthood. And they will start working towards transition with young people from the age of about 14. And I think one of the other issues is that the training for adult practitioners and child and adolescent practitioners often diverges very early on. So you have an adult psychiatric population who are, you know, may not know very much about ADHD. Time fluctuates as to whether or not, trainee psychiatrists have to do a child mental health job at all. But for large chunks of time, it's perfectly possible for somebody to become a general adult psychiatrist and never have had to think about or work with anyone who has ADHD. So it's no surprise then that now child mental health services are routinely dealing with it. We are struggling to support those who become too old to still come to our services for young people but need ongoing support. So I was involved in a SDO, so that's the Service Delivery and Organisation funding stream from the Department of Health. They funded a study called TRACK, which was published in about 2009, and that studied transition in general. Now, out of that study, what came through was that young people with neurodevelopmental difficulties, including ADHD, seemed to get a particular raw deal, but there weren't enough of them in the study to study in depth. So the CATCHER study has three strands to it. First of all, there's a surveillance study, which uses the surveillance units at the Royal College of Paediatrics, which is called the British Paediatric Surveillance Unit, and at the Royal College of Psychiatrists, which is called the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Surveillance System. And what these systems do is they collect every month on a number of studies, cards, which are now emails, go out to consultant paediatricians or psychiatrists, child psychiatrists respectively, to say, have you seen a young person that fits the criteria of, and there may be several studies listed. Now, we had to really push the surveillance units to do this study with us because ADHD is not uncommon, but sadly, successful transition is. So we set out to establish a lower limit of the number of young people who might need transition by saying they had to have a diagnosis of ADHD. They had to be coming up to the age boundary of the service that the consultant worked in. We didn't specify what that was, but we asked them to tell us what it was. So we've got some really interesting data about the potential gap between child services, which should go up to 18 because adult services don't come down lower. But actually, you know, there's variation around the country, and that they had to be taking medication that they still needed and still wanted to take. Now, that's a very narrow group of the young people with ADHD, and we're not for a minute saying that the only treatments are medication. But I think you can't possibly quibble that as the NICE guidelines recommend shared care between specialists and primary care, that these children don't, these young adults don't need a service. So, these data are being analysed and they're being triangulated with data from the electronic note system at South London and Maudsley to see how accurate they are. From that, we hope to be able to give an estimate, a lower band estimate, of how many young adults every year we should be expecting to provide a service for. So it's not complicated science, but actually it's very, very important for people with that diagnosis. The other thing we have done, and I should say this study is funded by the National Institute of Health Research, and they said they wanted us to add in a mapping study where we try to gather data about what services are currently provided. And it became very quickly apparent at our first steering meeting, where even in our own region we couldn't agree. Different people had different knowledge about what was available and the realities of what that was available, was that this needed to be quite a complex study, and it wasn't so much about getting one response from every area, but that actually we needed to go for multiple perspectives and triangulate them. And we've done that. We've spent a large chunk of last year, about 6 months, trying out different ways of getting to child practitioners, adult practitioners, young adults and young people themselves via the various voluntary organisations, commissioners, primary care, and we used a variety of methods, from freedom of information requests, which was the most effective way to get to get commissioners to respond to us, to direct emails via the Royal Colleges, to putting things out on Twitter. And then this spring, or this just January and February, we ran a very quick focus study, which will be our definitive study, where we got data from everybody at the same time. If anybody's interested, we have an interactive map on the Exeter Medical School website from our pilot data, and that will be updated by the end of the year, and then handed over to one of the voluntary sector organisations as a resource for both clinicians to find where to refer to, and young adults who need to know where services are. So that's two streams. And the final stream is some really complex and in-depth qualitative interviews. And again, we have the most enormous amount of data, because we have spoken to young people of three age groups. Now, we know, or our clinical colleagues tell us, there is a massive drop-off in those attending services after the age of 16. And that could be because people like me say, you know, you need your medication to cope at school, and young adults don't see the need to come. It could be because there are subtle signals that, you know, this is a child service, you sit in a waiting room which is full of dolls' houses and toys, and that might not feel terribly appropriate when you're 17. And there isn't a lot of work about where to go to next, so they drift away. Now, ethically, it's quite hard to find the people who've dropped out. So what we did was we interviewed young people between the age of 14 or 16, because had they had diabetes or epilepsy, our paediatric colleagues would already be working with them and introducing them to the adult team. So we spoke to young teenagers, we spoke to people who transitioned straight across at the age of 18 without any gap in service. Needless to say, they were the hardest group to find. And then there were a really interesting group who come back into services in their 20s, often with stories of things having gone really quite wrong when they dropped out of services, as well as parents and practitioners working in child services and practitioners working in adult services. And we're in the process of drawing out the messages from all these different perspectives.
And looking into the future, Tamsin, I mean, what are some of the biggest challenges facing child and adolescent psychiatry at the moment?
Well, I think there are some kind of systemic issues. I think there are some research governance issues. And I think in the clinical world, CAN's colleagues are facing horrendous pressures. And I think there are two things going on that are really compounding things. Firstly, the current financial climate with sustained cuts to services year on year on year means that we are constantly being asked to keep up the same level of service provision with less resources to provide it. But also, child mental health is really everybody's business, and everybody else is facing the same cuts. So whereas a decade or so ago there were voluntary sector services, there were more children's centres offering parenting, there were more youth groups that did a lot of low-level work. Schools are being cut to the bone, so sometimes pastoral support, school counsellors, parent support advisors, they are seen as less essential than the academic provision of teaching, and I can understand that, but there is a pulling back of other services from the kind of joined up working that was going on, which means that I think more people are being referred because there isn't a lower level of service, and they're often in deeper distress by the time they get there because that earlier work hasn't been done. I think there is less time to be involved in research, which is a real issue for people like me who work alongside clinical colleagues, because the pressure on my clinical colleagues is just so intense that a lot of things that they would have been able to do 5 to 10 years ago now is more of a struggle. And I think we absolutely need good research governance, but I think at times people's anxiety about getting it wrong has meant that research governance in and of itself is stopping people getting early experiences in research. So things that would have been projects that trainee psychologists or psychiatrists might have taken on now are almost impossible for them to do because the research governance itself soaks up all the time they would have to do it. And I think there is a lot of anxiety about data protection, which may not necessarily be accurate or be in the spirit of what was intended by the Act. And I hear very conflicting messages, and I'm just very, very worried that the understanding that, you know, data saves lives, and that, yes, we should be very careful of how we use privileged data, but that we need to make sure that we don't set up a situation where we can't do good, high-quality research, and that we don't have a workforce that's trained to do it well.
Moving on to your time with ACAM now, Tamsin, I mean, how did you first get involved with the charity? What drew you into it?
Well, I think the really big appeal of ACAM is that it's multidisciplinary, and there is nothing that I do clinically or academically that is only psychiatry or any other discipline for that matter. But ACAM is the only organisation that deals with evidence-based practice in relation to mental health, regardless of the setting and regardless of who is providing it. And I think that's so, so important. I first got involved as a member when I started my child psychiatry training. So I was at the what was then the Bethlehem and Maudsley and now would be South London and Maudsley NHS Trust training rotation. And we were all encouraged to attend the national conferences as part of our training and to consider becoming a member. And I found the national conferences probably the best conferences that I'd ever been to because of the breadth of their appeal. And so I then got more involved when I was invited to join the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Journal as an editor, having done a fair bit of reviewing for them, which again I found a really useful experience. So I would encourage anyone who's interested in research and has, you know, some experience of research, maybe sort of master's level, to get involved in reviewing other people's work because it improves your writing. And likewise, editing makes, again, you know, having to kind of think about, is this suitable for this journal? Does it fit? Is it done well enough? It just makes your own submissions to other people's journals. You start spotting the regular mistakes and you start seeing a breadth of how to do it well or not so well. So I was an editor on Child and Adolescent Mental Health for 7 years. And for the last 3 years of that, I was the lead editor. And that involved staying, you know, representing Child and Adolescent Mental Health at board meetings and I was encouraged to stay on as a board member after my term as editor finished. And, you know, I think the importance of ACAM is such that, you know, I was glad to do so.
During your, I mean, you've been involved and a member of and board member with ACAM for a long time. I mean, what particular, can you point to a particular example of any impact you've seen ACAM have?
Well, I think the national conferences attract a wide base of people. I mean, traditionally, the majority are psychologists and psychiatrists, but it does go much broader than that. There, I think, you know, you don't want a board that doesn't change at all. It's important to have new blood and new ideas. But you need a certain degree of stability because otherwise the organisation has no memory. I think it's a particularly interesting time and exciting time to be part of ACAM because I think we have a particularly vibrant board and vibrant back office at the moment, and things like these podcasts, a commitment to continuing professional development, a wanting to get more involved actively in research rather than being the dissemination channel, all of which is really exciting to see. So I don't think there is another organisation that does quite what we do. I think the journals, particularly the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, have a huge impact on the research and its dissemination. And I think through the branches and through the national conferences, we have a big impact on practitioners. I think what I would like to see in the future is reaching out to our colleagues in education, who I think are underrepresented, and maybe with the current policy direction, that will begin to happen naturally.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to speak to you, Tamsin.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.